Well, that was amazing, wasn't it? I don't know how to follow that. That sounds like a sermon to me. It says, his scars poured mercy that would plead for me, that I might live and in his name be known. I give my all to gain the hope that never dies. That'll preach. That's good. Well, I'm really excited to be with you this morning. It's always great to be at Altadena Valley. And just want to say thank you so much right off the bat. Thank you for being so faithful in your prayers for me and my family and the ministry on the reservation. Thank you for giving sacrificially for years to enable us to be there, and even for coming. Many of you have been to the reservation and served there, and we're just really grateful for all the involvement and the encouragement and the support that you guys have provided. I'm always happy when I get to come and be with you guys, and we're really glad to be here. So thank you. Frequently asked questions. I know Friday night I had to explain what I was wearing, and I have to do that again this morning. What are you wearing there? This is actually a more traditional, more conservative outfit than what I had on Friday night, believe it or not. This is called a ribbon shirt, and this is the way men would dress in our culture if they belong to the longhouse, which is the traditional religion of the people where we live. So this is a very traditional conservative outfit that a traditional man would wear to a funeral or a wedding or a feast or any important gathering. So I'm wearing my ribbon shirt and my medallion today. Also, people want to know, well, what are you excited about? What's the Lord doing right now on the reservation? Before I get to that, though, a lot of times we hear, well, how did you wind up on the reservation in the first place? I grew up right around here, just a mile north of Briarwood. I had friends that lived in this neighborhood and knew folks at Altadena Valley as long as I can remember. So how in the world did you get from Birmingham, Alabama, to Washington State, to an Indian reservation? Well, there's a long version of the story that I don't have time to tell. The short version is I was a youth director at Oak Mountain Presbyterian, and every summer we took a group somewhere to serve like you guys do. And we had been to Miami and D.C. and various places, but in the summer of 2000, the opportunity to go to an Indian reservation, the Yakima Nation in Washington State, came up to work in a little town called White Swan. I had never even heard of the Yakima Nation. I really didn't have a heart for Native America, truth be told. I didn't have a heart for folks that were struggling with addiction. I really didn't have a heart for the poor. So the Lord's done a lot of work in me since that time. But I took my group to White Swan in June of 2000, and the short version of the story is the kids, in particular, stole my heart, and I've never been the same since that week. Came back to Birmingham when that week was over, and everything was just like I left it, but nothing was the same. And over the next year and a half, Mary and I began to realize that God was calling our family to move to this little town, this community in White Swan, which sounded like the craziest thing I had ever heard of. We didn't feel qualified. We didn't think we knew anything, and we didn't. I wasn't ordained, and I thought they desperately needed a church in that community. There wasn't a healthy church there. Most of the kids we met had never even heard of Jesus, which was shocking to me. I remember coming back and driving from my house to Oak Mountain. The next day I went to work, I counted the churches I drove by, and I drove by 22 churches to get to Oak Mountain, and there wasn't a single healthy church in the little town of White Swan. And I guess, again, short version, I couldn't live with that. That just ate away at me. And I remember thinking, we just got to spread out. We're all grouped up down here. We got to spread out. So finally, the Lord made it clear that he wanted us to move to the reservation full time. Since then, we've been there almost 15 years now. Since that time, I did get ordained. I didn't think I was the guy to plant the church, but the Lord thought I was. And so in a kind of an amazing set of circumstances, became ordained in the PCA, and I'm now the pastor. So what are we excited about? Well, we have a church now. They're meeting this morning as well. And on a typical Sunday, we'll have anywhere from 50 to 70 little kids, fifth grade and younger, Most of them are functional orphans, actually. Most of them come without any adults. They just jump. We have buses that go out, vans that go out, and the kids jump on the bus and come to church. Reminds me of one story. One of our buses pulled up in front of a house, and the little boy inside didn't realize it was Sunday morning. When I see the kids in the community, they often ask me, is today Sunday? And they're looking forward to church so much. But this little guy didn't know it was Sunday, and he was still in bed, I guess. But he heard the bus, and so he jumped out of bed and came running out of the house with no clothes on. He was about 6 years old, 5 or 6 years old, completely naked, ran into the bus because he was afraid he was going to get left. And he knew, if I can get to church, they'll take care of all the rest. I just got to get there, and they've got clothes and stuff. So he came running up on the bus, and the bus driver was like, whoa, we're not in that big a hurry. You know, you can go get dressed, and I'll wait for you. I promise. You promise? Yeah, I promise. I'll be here. And I told that story in South Georgia, and the pastor asked his church, he said, when was the last time you were so excited to get to church? You ran out the door naked, you know. So the Lord is on the move. And our church family is just, it's wonderful. It's amazing. Nobody in our church has ever been in church before, really. I mean, nobody ever says, you know, in my old church, we used to do it this way. I never hear that. It's all brand new. And so it's an exciting place to be. So lots and lots of children. Somebody said when we dismiss our kids to children's church, we should dismiss the adults instead and just let the children stay. But anyway, we'll have 50 to 70 little kids, fifth grade and under, on a Sunday morning, probably 25 to 30 teenagers, and maybe 25 to 30 adults as well. So the average age is like 9 or something, I don't know. But it's a very vibrant church family. And it's like Christmas morning for a lot of the kids that come, and even some of the teenagers. It's like Christmas morning every Sunday, and which is a wonderful thing. Our youth group is exploding. On a normal Tuesday night, we have 100 or more kids. On special events, we'll have 150 to 170 teenagers come. We were able to start Young Life in the schools just a little over a year ago, and that's taken off like a rocket. And also economic development is brand new, and it's gathering steam, and the young people are involved in that, and are really there's a waiting list of teenagers that want to be in on the economic development program. There's after-school programs and all sorts of other things. In summary, what are we excited about? We're excited that the community where we are has responded so strongly to us and to the gospel. And we're excited about the way the church nationwide has responded to the opportunity to love our first neighbors well. So the Lord is on the move, and the kingdom's growing. His family's growing wider, deeper, stronger. And it's a thrill to be part of it. So thank you again for that. Friday night, we started the conference looking at the Good Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan. And the passage is printed there in your bulletin. It really runs parallel to what we're going to talk about today. A very, very similar story that we're going to look at today. But the first thing I asked you to do was think about a time when you were stuck. And maybe stuck in a ditch. I talked about one time I got one of our 15 pastor vans stuck in a ditch. We get stuck in ditches quite often on the reservation. So stuck in a ditch. Spinning my wheels, couldn't go anywhere. Somebody had to come rescue me, like Brad was talking about earlier, right? One of our drivers, I told him Friday night, he got a bus, I guess you call it high-centered on a road, a dirt road, and he had both sets of wheels in two ditches. And that's a lot tougher to get out of. We had to get another bus and come pull that bus out of there. But so getting stuck. But think about a time that you were stuck in something, not a physical ditch, but something worse. Have you ever been stuck emotionally, spiritually, just down in the dumps, maybe stuck in a really bad situation? In the early service, we talked about that's a key part of trauma. When somebody goes through a very traumatic situation, they're stuck in that situation. They can't get out of it, right? You think about a soldier in battle that's stuck in a rough situation, and they're being traumatized because they can't escape, right? I heard a story recently, that not going to tell all the details, but a husband and wife were in a multiple car pileup on a highway. It was foggy. There was a wreck, and then the cars just kept smashing into the ones in the back because they couldn't see, and 18-wheelers are smashing into everybody. And this couple, they were in their car. One minute, everything's fine. The next minute, they managed to stop before they hit the car in front of them. But an 18-wheeler hit them from behind and smashed them into the next car. There was a young woman by herself in that car, trapped, stuck in the car, and it burst into flames. And the couple in this car were trapped. They couldn't get out. They couldn't do anything to help her. And they had to hopelessly watch as she passed away in that car wreck. And they were trapped. She was trapped. She was stuck in that car that was on fire. They were stuck in their car, helpless to do anything about her situation, right? Stuck. How does it feel to be stuck? I hope none of you are stuck in marriages that are like that, but maybe so. You can get stuck in relationships like that. You can get stuck in a job like that. I remember one guy, I was about 40 years old. He said, I wish I could meet the 18-year-old that decided I wanted to do what I'm doing now and punch him right in the face. You know, where is that kid? We get stuck. We get stuck. And sometimes it's even worse than all of that. I wanted to tell you a story about a lady that I met years ago who was stuck in a bad situation. And then we're going to look at a passage that is really central to our call to the reservation in the first place, but I think it's central to the Christian life in my mind. It's certainly central to missions. But one day I got a phone call, and I didn't want to take it because I was super busy. I had my whole day planned out and all this stuff, and I had all this stuff I thought was really important to do. I didn't think there was anything more important than what I had in front of me that day. And the phone rang, and I said, don't answer it, but then I answered it, and it was Wendell Hannigan. He's my native father. He actually gave me an Indian name, and he gave me this, the day I got my Indian name, I got this ribbon shirt as well. I kind of think if it had been almost anybody else, I wouldn't have answered it, but since it was Wendell, I felt like I had to grab it, so I did. And he said, hey, Chris, are you busy? And my mind said, yes, 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 completely swamped. I don't even have time to tell you I'm busy. But my mouth said, no, what's up? And I was like, what? And yes, I'm busy. No, what you got going on? He said, well, I kind of have a crisis, have an emergency situation. I'm like, that's constant. It's almost not worth saying on the reservation. It's just a constant crisis. Like, the reservation is a disaster relief field where there was no disaster response. And the disaster was us, right? If you go to Native America, if you go to the reservations, it's like there was a hurricane that swept through Native America and just wiped people out. Not just physically, but emotionally and every other way. Families just destroyed, right? And then there was no response. You know, imagine if Hurricane Katrina hit and nobody responded. That's Native America. And then just add 100 years, 150 years on top of that. And that's what we got. So Wendell says, we've got an emergency. I'm like, yeah, we're awake and walking around, so we have an emergency. He said, there's a lady I know, a single mom who was out of town. She got back late last night and somebody had kicked in her doors and stolen all kinds of stuff out of her house. And they broke the door frames when they kicked the doors in. They stole the keys to the house. So she can't secure her house tonight. And she's terrified. She suspected it was her ex-husband and some of his buddies that did this because they knew where all the expensive stuff was hidden, mostly beadwork and regalia that was 100 years old and things like that. So they went to all the right spots to steal everything, but they were obviously coming back because they stole the house keys. So she was in a panic. She was traumatized. She didn't know what to do. So Wendell said, can you come fix the doors? Well, fixing the doors is nothing new. There's nothing novel about repairing doors. I've done that so much because doors are constantly getting kicked in on the reservation. A little old lady called me one time and she said, can you come fix my doors? Because they're messed up so bad that the dogs push the doors open and come into the kitchen and climb up on the table and eat food that I need for my grandkids, you know. And I can't keep the dogs out of the house. They're not inside dogs. They're like semi-stray dogs. And they would just push the door open and come in. That's how bad her doors were. So I went and spent a whole day fixing all her doors. And then a week later, the police came and kicked them all in and arrested her grandson and took him off to jail. I had to go fix them again, you know. So doors are getting kicked in all the time. Homes are not secure. Fixing doors is nothing exciting or new. But I couldn't tell Wendell no. So, and I didn't know this lady, but I hated the thought of her not being safe at all that night. So, and I thought, well, at least I'll get to hang out with Wendell. You know, he still doesn't claim to be a Christian. He used to say, you know, Chris, when he would speak, I think he spoke here one time. He said, Chris is saying this stuff over here about Jesus, but I'm over here and this is what I believe. But recently we were in Jackson, Mississippi, and he said, I'm just right there. He's about 75 years old now, I think 76. He said, I'm right there. So pray for Wendell. But I remember that day I thought, well, at least I get to hang out with Wendell. Maybe he'll pray to receive Christ today. Maybe today is the day of his salvation. So I went and scouted out the situation, looked at the lady's doors, and we barely got there before Wendell said, well, I've got some meetings I got to go to, so he left. And now, to complicate things, now I'm one-on-one with this lady in her house, which I don't ever do for a lot of reasons, but I'm worried about appearances, I'm worried about rumors and all this stuff, and I'm just like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into? So anyway, I measured the doors. I made a list of everything I needed. I drove like 45 minutes to Home Depot and spent an hour buying stuff and drove back out to White Swan and spent the rest of the day fixing her doors. And I'm dyslexic, so I always put the doors on, the knobs on backwards so that the burglars can like lock you in your house every time. I don't know why. And so I have to take them all apart, redo it. And sometimes I've done it twice in a row, you know. And then, so anyway, so finally, the doors are locked and the new doors are in and the keys, and give those to her. And she, the whole day, she's just crying and going from room to room, figuring out what else is missing. And I was nervous about being there, and I didn't want to, she didn't know me, and I'm a big white guy, and trying not to freak her out anymore. So on the way home, I realized that I'd spent all that, pretty much the whole day there. And I hadn't figured out a way to pray with her. I certainly hadn't figured out a way to share the gospel with her. And about halfway home, I thought, what kind of missionary are you? You know, like a real missionary would have figured out how to at least pray for the lady. You know, a real missionary would have figured out how to explain the gospel to her, even if she is upset. And then I got a little closer to home, and I thought, on top of that, by the way, you were supposed to do something completely different today, and you totally did. What kind of man says, today I'm going to do this, and then doesn't do it? You know. So by the time I got to dinner, I was just all down in the dumps, went to bed sad, woke up the next day, did all the stuff I planned to do, and forgot about the whole thing. Well, a couple of weeks later, the phone rang. I looked at it. It's Wendell. I was like, oh, no. Somebody kicked in this lady's doors again. So reluctantly, I answered the phone. He said, hey, did you hear about Arlen? Was the lady's name. You hear about Arlen? I was like, no, I didn't hear about Arlen. He said, well, I just found out she's running for tribal council down in Warm Springs, Oregon. And I was like, tribal council, what? I was like, first of all, she's not from Oregon. She's from White Swan, Washington. This other reservation is about 3 hours south. Why is she trying to get elected down there? This doesn't make sense. But he went on to explain, well, she's from there. She's lived up here for a long, long time, but she's running all this. I'm thinking, well, she's not going to get elected if she moved out of Warm Springs 20 years ago. They're not about to elect her as a leader. But then I also found out she's brilliant. She's working on her PhD. She teaches classes at Oregon State. I was like, wow. And then he tells me, and oh, by the way, she's a Christian. I'm like, seriously? Okay, well, that's fantastic. There's all kind of stuff I don't know about Arlen. And he's like, yeah, I just thought you'd want to know. Hung up. All right. 2 weeks later, phone rang in. It's Wendell. Huh? Hey, Wendell, what's up? You hear about Arlen? No, I didn't hear about Arlen. Well, she got elected in Warm Springs. I'm like, oh, the white guy's wrong again. Look at that. She got elected to tribal council in Warm Springs, Oregon. Okay, wow. And the very first thing she did was call Wendell. And she said, what do I need to do to get Chris's people? So we're in a collectivist culture. So I'm kind of the chief. So if y'all come out there, you're going to be my people. So you might want to think about that. twice before. But what do we need to do to get Chris's people to come to Warm Springs to share the hope and the light and the love that they're sharing with the folks in White Swan? That was her first act on the tribal council. And sure enough, we started sending folks down there. And we've been doing it for 10 years now. And we're on the verge of having full-time people there in Warm Springs. So you can pray for that. But one of the things about that story, Arlen was stuck, right? She was stuck in a really bad situation, a dangerous situation. She knows how that feels. You know, Jesus knows how that feels. And that, when you stop and think about it, that really is our story too, right? We were stuck in our sins. We were stuck. We were dead in our sins and transgressions. We couldn't even want to get unstuck. We couldn't even call for help, right? So we know that feeling. We know that story. Isaiah 58, verses 6 through 12 points to that, talks about that. And again, I feel like it runs parallel to the story of the Good Samaritan, which so many stories do. So God says to his people through Isaiah, he says, "Is not this the kind of fasting that I've chosen? To loose the chains of injustice, to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free, and to break every yoke." Now, the first time I ran across that, I thought, well, that sounds like a job for Superman. So that's one of those verses I don't really have to pay attention to because I'm just a regular guy. Well, the Lord knew that folks like me would say that, so he gave us verse 7, which breaks it down so we know exactly what he's talking about. It says in verse 7, "Is it not to share your food with the hungry, to provide the poor wanderer or the homeless with shelter?" One version says, "to bring the homeless poor into your house. When you see the naked, to clothe them, and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood." So I remember reading that, and I'm like, okay, I get that. I understand what it means to share my food. I can picture bringing a homeless person into my house. So now I'm not confused about what he's talking about, but now I'm scared. I don't know if you've ever brought a homeless person into your house. You don't sleep the same way with a homeless person in your house as you do when they're outside. So that's, you know, clothing the naked, feeding the poor, feeding the hungry. I know what he's talking about. So now it's not complicated, but it's not easy, right? "And not to turn away from your own flesh and blood." Now, this would have gotten Isaiah in hot water with the people he was talking to back in the day, because like native folks that we serve, it was a collectivist culture. It was a tribal system, right? So your people, who are your people, your clan, that's everything. You know, in mainstream America, we have a resume. We say, oh, this is what I've done. This is what I've studied. In tribal cultures like this one that was being spoken to, your clan is your resume, right? So to say your people are homeless, your people are naked and hungry, a little further down it says oppressed and afflicted, that would have been an insult to the people Isaiah was speaking to. And that would have been confusing. They were, wait a minute, my people are fine. What are you talking about, my people, my flesh and blood? They're fine. But what Isaiah is doing is he's reminding God's people of their own story, right? He's like, were you ever naked? Were you ever hungry? Were you ever homeless? Were you ever in bondage, oppressed? And there was, oh yeah, Egypt, right? We were slaves in Egypt. And God heard our cries for help and he sent Moses. He responded. That is our, those are our people. Our people are not, what God's saying is your people are not just the Hebrews. They're the folks that are slaves of every sort. You've been there. But that's us too, right? Our people, who are our people? Our people are the ones that have been rescued. Were we ever naked? Yeah, spiritually exposed like Adam and Eve before a holy God, right? Nowhere to hide. Fig leaves aren't going to help. Were we ever hungry? Yeah, starving to death, dead. But then Jesus, the bread of life, came. Were we ever homeless? Yeah. And Jesus has taken us in, not just into his home, into his family, but into his heart. We belong now, right? So it makes sense that if we know that story, if we've lived that, we're going to love the folks who don't know the story yet. we're going to relate to and love the ones who are still afflicted. Let's keep going here. In verse 8, it says, as you do this, as you love the poor and turn toward your own flesh and blood, it says, then your light will break forth like the dawn. Your healing will quickly appear. Your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. I'm not going to build the case, but there's something really cool right there. Your righteousness will go before you. That didn't sound good to me at first. I'm like, that means nothing's in front of me. No, but Jesus is my righteousness. He's the one in front. He's our shepherd. We're the sheep. It makes sense. He would go before us and we would follow, right? So the righteous one will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you'll call and the Lord will answer. You'll cry for help and he'll say, here I am. If you do away with the yoke of oppression, now think about Native America for a minute, what you know. This always gets me. Do away with the yoke of oppression and with the pointing finger and malicious talk. There's a lot of malicious talk about Native America, right? Lots of pointing fingers. One of the worst things to hear, and it happens regularly at a missions conference, is for somebody to come up and say, why don't the Indians just, whatever they say next is really not helpful. Because it is not a simple situation, right? It's very complicated. And Native folks are not stupid. Like, if it was just anything, they would have figured this out by now. You know? They're more motivated than whoever's asking me that question, right? Because they're stuck in that situation. So, pointing finger and malicious talk. What he's saying is there's no place for that among God's people. No place for pointing fingers and malicious talk. Not based on where we came from, right? When we remember our story and remember where we would be without Jesus, are we tempted to engage in malicious talk and pointing fingers? No way. I should be dead. You know, at best case scenario, I'd be in prison forever. I was on a bad road. And if Jesus had left me alone, I wouldn't have made it. So where do I get off with pointing fingers and malicious talk? Verse 10, it says, if you spend yourself, another version says, pour yourself out. Think about Jesus being the drink offering, right? If you spend yourself or pour yourself out on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed or the afflicted, then your light will rise in the darkness. Your night will become like the noonday. Have you ever spent much time with the afflicted? They're not all that much fun to hang out with. Right? Folks that are afflicted and oppressed are dealing with a boatload of problems. And it's just not a whole lot of fun, you know? And another thing is, we don't have all the answers. there's people that are stuck in horrible situations. Right now, I could list names probably for an hour of people I know who are stuck in horrible situations. I know Jesus is the answer. But I don't know how to, children that I don't know how to get them out of horrible situations they're stuck in. That's disturbing. Hanging out with the afflicted and the oppressed. But it says your light will rise in the darkness. Your night will become like the noonday. It says in verse 11, the Lord will guide you always. That's really good. In cross-cultural ministry, working with the poor, pretty much everything everybody, all the missionaries here are doing, we're winging it most of the time. Like, we really don't know. I mean, we're just trusting the Lord to guide us, just like I did with Arlen's house that day, right? I didn't know what was going on. Putting the doorknobs on backwards. It says, he'll guide you always. He'll satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. You'll be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. Pray that the Lord would do that, continue to do that with me and my family and my church, my people, that the Lord would fill us up with the living water to overflowing so that Native people in the sun-scorched land would come and be satisfied and be saved, right? Let me close with this. There's a lot of controversy in Native America. I want to mention this. There's a handful of things that aren't controversial, and that's what we prefer to focus on most of the time. So, I mean, if you want to talk about casinos, like, we can do that. Somebody, this is bad. At a missions conference one time, somebody came up to me and said, "Why do they need you guys? Don't they have a casino?" And I was like, "They don't need Jesus because they have a casino? Is that what you're saying?" I didn't even know what to say. But so there's lots of controversy. If you ask the wrong questions, you always get the wrong answers too. But anyway, there's a lot of controversy in Native America, right? We can talk about entitlement mentality. We can talk about the history and argue about who did what and whatever. There's a lot of controversy. But here's a few things that are not controversial, right? Jesus tells us to love our neighbors. Even atheists believe that. Secondly, the very first neighbors of the American church were Native Americans. So if you go back to the colonies, keep on going, we've had 500 years of contact. 500 years since contact was made with Native Americans. The third fact is today there's about 3 million American Indians in the United States, and only about 2 to 5% claim to be Christian. It's virtually an unreached people group right here in our own country. That's on us. Like, it's not good enough for us to stand back and say, well, our doors are open, you know, they can come. No. We got to go to them, right? We got to go to where they are. And they don't care what the heck we have to say until they know that we care about them, that we really care about them. Usually they don't really think that until we have suffered, actually, alongside them. So those things aren't controversial. These are our very first neighbors. They're in desperate need, all sorts of need, but especially Jesus. And we need you to stick with us. You guys have been a huge support for so long. We need you. They need you. So maybe you're asking, well, what can I do? You know, am I supposed to move to the res? Maybe. Maybe not. What I would encourage you to do, first step, maybe, is fill this thing out. Your faith promise. The majority of support that comes from Altadena Valley to missionaries all over the world comes through the faith promise giving. And the missions committee and the leadership, they can't decide what they're going to do unless they know what you guys have promised to give in faith, right? This is over and above the tithe. So it would be a step of faith on your part. It would be a sacrifice on your part to step out and say, you know, I want to give a little extra this year. I'm going to trust God to enable me to give a little bit extra to help Chris and his family and all the other missionaries do what they're doing. And behind every mission, behind every missionary, there's a group of folks praying and giving. We couldn't be there without folks just like you. So thank you for that. Let's pray. Lord, when we think about what you've done for us, when we remember our own story, think about the fact that you are the ultimate Samaritan. We think about the Samaritan in the story stopping at the risk of his life, but how you came to us at the expense of your life. You gave up your life so that we could be made alive and so that we could be adopted into your family. Lord, everything we just looked at in Isaiah 58, all the hard stuff, that's us. We were poor wanderers, homeless, naked. We were oppressed and afflicted, but you didn't turn away from us. If anybody ever could have pointed fingers and engaged in malicious talk, it's you, and you would have been pointing right at us. But instead, you said, nope, they are my own flesh and blood, and I'm going to go get them. Lord, it would make sense for us as we remember our own story to turn and reach out to others who don't know you yet, to reach out to those around us who are still struggling, who still are actually dead in their sins. Lord, fill us with courage, fill us with humility, Fill us with faith and hope and love and send us out. Lord, put people in front of us who desperately need to know you. And I pray that you would fill us with your love and your truth, with the gospel. In your name we pray. Amen.